Welcome to the Continued Silence with me, Emma Taylor, on UK Health Radio. The Continued Silence is focused on the very uncomfortable conversations of child sexual abuse and the importance of talking openly about this subject. We want to try and normalise the conversation. Child sexual abuse is real. It affects millions of people, young and old, across the world. The work we do is very much engaging more lateral thought processes on this terrible crime, supporting survivors, protecting children, and helping those not wanting to listen to listen. Joining me each show is my panel, activist Chris Tuck and therapist Denny Corby. Unfortunately, Denny's not with us today, but we look forward to having her back with us on the next show. Each show that we do, we are joined with guests from around the world to share more insights on this conversation and help us to share more important messages. I'm really excited to share that for this show, we are joined by Nancy Morris. We are going to be talking about sibling sexual abuse. And we are going to be discussing the storyline about to hit the UK here in the UK on Soap Hollyoaks. So Nancy, Chris, great to have you with me today. Thank you both of you for joining. Chris, you know, I always think it's a brave move when anyone speaks openly about child sexual abuse, sibling sexual abuse, but to actually put it into a soap opera. And I don't know any details about soap opera, whether it's going to be done in 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks. I hope it's going to be done over a long period of time, because as we know, this isn't just a half an hour show, move on to the next one. It's important, Chris, they get this right, isn't it?
100%. And I think why it's so important that a soap opera is taking it up is because here in the United Kingdom, we all love a soap. We all can get behind one of the major soaps that are happening in the UK. And so I think when it's actually being beamed into your living room on a programme that you're invested in, for whatever reason, I think it's more palatable, for one. And I think you take it on board a lot more, because it's, oh, well, you've got this kind of relationship with the soap that you've invested in. Many of us have been watching a particular soap for 10, 20, 30 years, especially if you're our ages. And it's just a good way of getting these really difficult conversations across to the general public, who may not be aware of these very in-depth and complicated conversations like sexual abuse and sibling sexual abuse, especially.
I am sure this show is going to come with lots of trigger warnings. And I hope that it, like you say, everyone loves the soap. This is a really good way to raise awareness of this conversation. And, you know, in a way that is a bit more palatable for so many people, but still going to be very uncomfortable. And one of the story, so Frankie Osborne was left traumatised as twin brother JJ entered her room in the middle of the night in scenes which confirmed a sibling sexual abuse story. And I hope that they give this the time it needs to be properly heard, which I'm sure it will, because I think they're being supported by SARS as well, and we know that they do amazing work. So yeah, it's going to be really interesting. Anyway, thank you, Chris. Nancy, great to have you with us. This is a storyline I think that's going to be very interesting for all sorts of reasons. What are your thoughts on it, first of all, Nancy?
I agree with what Chris said. I mean, I used to live in the UK. I'm familiar with Hollyoaks. I'm a Corey fan since I was a little kid, because my mom used to watch it when I got home from school here in Canada, and it was always on. So I watched Corey, and I dragged my husband into watching it when we first started dating. So I agree that the soaps, though, can carry messages, and the soaps in the United Kingdom in particular are sort of famous for being able to take a responsible and sensitive approach to different storylines. I mean, in across the different soaps, there's been all sorts of challenging and difficult subjects that they've brought to the fore, so that, you know, as you were saying, it becomes a little bit more palatable, a little bit more in the public discourse, and it creates discussion, which activists like myself and others, that's what we're trying to do, is create discussion, but do so in a way where real facts and information are available rather than it being totally dramatized like it has been in a couple of television programs in other jurisdictions. We're not going to name anything, but in other jurisdictions around the world, that is more salacious. So, yes, it's a soap opera, so it has to have that sort of dramatic effect. It must keep an audience entertained. And of course, one of the things about a soap is that there's a number of different storylines in each episode, right? So it's not just a single storyline in an episode. So they've got to intermix it with other storylines. So that creates some challenges, I'm sure, for the script writers and the producers. But my understanding of their approach and is that they're going to be very sensitive and very responsible for it. As you say, they're in touch with SARSAS, who are going to be giving them the best information, and along with what I've read online about, they've sought out survivors and professionals who work in the domain and, these sorts of things. So they're not just creating a bunch of rubbish. They really are looking at giving a very responsible approach. It is, however, going to be difficult for the audience. And I've been reading some of the online comments on the Hollyoaks Instagram account and things like that. There are people that are just absolutely stunned to the point where they're suggesting that this is all fake news, that this doesn't happen. And that, to me, is indicative of how much more work we need to do to help bring this information to the fore and educate people on the prevalence and the impacts and even some of the prevention strategies for sibling sexual abuse in particular. So.
I'm rolling my eyes. Chris is rolling her eyes. I find it really sad to hear that those are the comments there, but not unsurprised either. And, before we came on air, I said, there'll be a lot of positive that comes out of this for survivors of sibling sexual abuse. But there are also going to be the people on the other side of this that just think this just doesn't happen because. Wouldn't it be nice if we lived in that world where this didn't happen? But that's not true. And this is a storyline that's really important because those people thinking it isn't true will miss the importance of this conversation that could potentially affect their life.
So I just wanted to pick up on a few of your points. So I've done some work with Dr. Ellie Hansen around sibling sexual abuse. And these are her words, Nancy. No paper, because she's an academic, no paper I've read shows the levels of abuse and the complexities and the vulnerabilities of sibling sexual abuse. So she's worked in all different sectors of abuse, but that's what she said specifically about sibling sexual abuse. No one understands it. No one gets it yet because it's still the last taboo. Do you feel the same?
Yes and no. I have read some papers, particularly from Stuart Allardyce and Peter Yates in the UK, who are experts in this domain, and they've done a lot of work on impacts and prevalence and these sorts of things. But there is no doubt, and they'll be the first to admit in the papers that I've read from them, that it is so under-researched and underreported. We know that, what is it, something like 90% of people who endure child sexual abuse generally and siblings sexual abuse specifically won't disclose until they're adults. So it's super hard, and they won't disclose until they're either asked or, they're in an important relationship or whatever. So they don't disclose to authorities as such. So the numbers are all over the place in terms of prevalence, and that's one of the big challenges that we need to overcome in the near future is the dearth of research. We need more research to help people understand and to inform how do we prevent sibling sexual abuse, which in my opinion is the most preventable form of child abuse. How do we prevent it where it hasn't happened yet? But then also the research needs to happen so that we can talk about how do we intervene when it does happen. If all we ever do with sibling sexual abuse is throw, the court book at it, for example, only look at it from a criminal justice perspective, we're really not doing it a service at all. We are talking about children who are involved in abuse. We're not talking about adults here. So it is more of a public health issue rather than a completely and always criminal justice issue. So, for example, more research does need to happen. And what I really like about the fact that Hollyoaks has taken on this particular particular subject and ideally a responsible and sensitive way is it's going to create that public discourse. And we know that when the public get angry or frustrated or they want something to happen, well, looky, looky, we get some political will. More funding becomes available, more information becomes available, and all these things that we want, like more research and perhaps a view of sex education curriculum and these sorts of things, that will happen when the public decides it wants it to happen, and when the public reduces its stigma on these sorts of things. You know, when I lived in the UK, I worked in the mental health world, in a care in the community center. And it was, and I had always known this before, but it was in my face every day. The extent to which stigma, societal stigma, helps or hinders the subject we're trying to resolve. The higher the stigma, the less likely we're going to find solutions, create funding, create programs, all the rest of it, because the public just doesn't want to know. But if society can have these conversations, can have these sort of adult conversations, yes, this happens. Yes, we need to be looking at it. Well, then we can do something with it. So to me, one of the quote unquote villains in the topic of sibling sexual abuse is societal stigma. We've got to reduce that stigma. And things like the Hollyoaks program will create a lot of noise and people will be frustrated and they'll be saying, oh no, this never happens, or, you know, and all that's going on, but it will help to reduce the stigma. And what I found really interesting about watching the Instagram account was that survivors of SSA were jumping on board talking about, no, this does happen. It happened to me. And so you can look through hundreds of comments of people saying this happens and really reinforcing that message. And it kind of ideally will make society sit up and take notice of what is considered to be the number one form of family-based sexual abuse. So, you know, it's just a fact. It just is.
Interesting, I haven't seen the Instagram, but I will have a look at it after this recording today. It's really interesting, and I've seen that this in my own world, how once someone speaks up, it unfolds and more people talk and so on and so forth. But you're often met against resistance by other people's opinions, and that can be crippling for a survivor who may be just coming out, and that'll just put them back in their box. And so there is a responsibility, I think, for this conversation, Hollyoaks especially, when they are putting this show out, is the trolling that happens, and I'd be interested to see if they touch on that. I'm guessing maybe not, but that's an important part of this, shutting people up. People want to come forward, they want to share, but they're scared about society. And if this can open the door to help them speak up, that's great. And also to have some coping mechanisms should you be closed down, whether it be by a troll or even someone you know, even worse. But it happens all the time. We see it, we hear it, we know that happens. I have a question, Nancy. I'm really interested on your sort of take. As a survivor of sibling sexual abuse, clearly done a lot of work. I know you do, you were featured in an article in the National Press here. As a sibling, a survivor of sibling sexual abuse, what do you feel you want to see in that storyline that Hollyoaks is going to be sharing?
That's a great question because there's several things. First, like I don't get the show here in Canada. I can't even stream it, but I'm getting snippets from the Instagram and from various things. And what I've seen so far, I think that the actors in particular are doing a really good job of portraying the emotions, the range of emotions. What I hope to see in the storyline is that they look a little further into JJ's emotion, the person causing the harm. Are they going to play out a storyline that is him just really being a quote unquote predator in training? So one of these who might go on to cause harm and be abusive in future, Or are they going to delve into the other reality about sibling sexual abuse, is that the person who causes harm is quite often racked with shame and guilt themselves because the behavior stops. One of the things we know in sibling sexual abuse is that recidivism rates or repeat rates of behavior is low. And again, we need more research there, but we know that because if we take a health approach to SSA, we're looking at concepts of brain development, teenage brain development, and all of these sorts of things that can make the abuse only last a certain period of time. So I hope they look more into that because I really want it to reflect the fact that SSA is different than other types of child sexual abuse. And I hope that they look at that. But I also hope that they really respect that SSA has real life implications. SSA is a life-changing situation, as are all forms of sexual abuse. But we don't want to minimize this to it's like doctors and nurses, so we don't need to pay attention. It's there is natural curiosity quite often between siblings, but it's short-lived. It's like, oh, you show me yours, I'll show you mine. Laugh, giggle, go, ew, and move on. I want to make sure that people do not think that all types of contact between siblings is just natural curiosity. So I hope that they sort of develop that storyline because for me as a survivor, there's two things. Sibling sexual abuse is a problematic extension to a normal bit of behavior, i.e., that what I just sort of said to you, quite often there's natural curiosity. And that creates that quote unquote gray area, which causes parents some confusion sometimes. And even social workers and frontline people, they sort of think, oh, that's just kids being curious. That, as a survivor, that's a concern to me because that's not true. The other thing is that I can easily reach out to other survivors and be validated and encouraged by other survivors and get insight and all that, which is amazing and a truly, really important part of healing. But for me as a survivor, I want to be able to tell anybody that I want to tell that this occurred in my past, that this occurred in my life. But we go back to that societal stigma. I still, even at my age, which I'm in my early 60s now, I have amazing friends, but there are people I've told, even in the recent past, that just don't want to know. They don't necessarily think I'm making it up or that it doesn't happen. They just don't want to know. So that creates a block of communication with me and the rest of society,
But that's also
which is
becomes
upsetting.
but it also becomes very dangerous for children, for anyone to have that thought process, that they don't want to listen to you. It's uncomfortable, but actually you need to, right? Because the reason it's uncomfortable, because it is uncomfortable and it's horrible. I know Chris is waiting to speak to you, but I just have one other sort of point there. My abuse wasn't sibling sexual abuse. However, I've covered sort of various amount of work on it through my work, not as much as you. And just even seeing some of the clips I have seen and things, I find it uncomfortable, right? I find it quite triggering and quite uncomfortable to watch myself. But I know it happens and I know it's real. And I suspect, and I wonder, Nancy, you seem very strong about watching and gaining knowledge and research and absorbing it all. But are there moments yourself by just even watching this can be awkward for you?
Absolutely. There are times that I have to take a step back because it cuts a little too close to home, or I'm seeing something that I find frustrating, for example, in a storyline or in an article in a newspaper or something. And these sorts of things certainly trigger me. Interestingly, for my own podcast, I recently interviewed someone who caused harm to a sibling in the United States. And I have to say that threw me off for quite a period of time. That was very difficult. What I found really interesting, though, is as I sat across the Zoom call from him, and a number of emotions were going on at the same time, and he knows this because I said it right on the podcast, and I said to him afterwards, there's part of me that wants to have great empathy for you because when you caused harm to your sibling, you were a young boy, you had been exposed to and addicted to pornography at the age of 9, which is a whole other conversation, just how incredibly bad that is for brain development and all the rest of it. So I had empathy, but I also wanted to smack him. I was really angry. So those two emotions were hard for me to hold at the same time. But as I looked at him across the screen and he was talking to me with a desire to demonstrate that there is another side to this story, that he isn't a predator in training, that he isn't a pedophile, and all of these sorts of things, I remember thinking to myself, and it really upset me, my brother would never have the courage to do this. And so
I
it
think
takes a
it's all,
lot of courage.
and it's good that he spoke out, but there will be perpetrators who have continued to perpetrate. And I think,
Yes.
that's getting the balance of this conversation, which is not easy, and also very difficult, I would imagine, for the work that you're doing to have had that conversation. I have spoken to Chris about this before and about that crossover of conversation, and it is very difficult. To have interviews. I have spoken to paedophiles. I've spoken to paedophiles in prison on remand. And I think there are people out there doing great work, gaining knowledge of those conversations. And if that knowledge eradicates child sexual abuse, come back and tell me. I'm over here now doing what I can for prevention and support. And I think it's great that to hear that you've been able to sort of be fairly open to having these conversations and awareness, but also the reality that, not again, not one size fits all, right? And, the person you spoke to may not have gone on to perpetrate again, may have, may not, but it happened. And actually, what can you gain from that? What can that knowledge give you to be part of the prevention that you're doing?
So I think that's a very great point. And one thing to remember is, of course, there will be people who perpetrate harm when they're younger, who will go on to harm others as they get older for all sorts of different reasons. I personally refer to those people who are less likely to demonstrate remorse and these sorts of things. They are to me a quote unquote predator in training in my head. That's a very general and harsh term, but this is how I, as a survivor, differentiate them between those who have caused harm as a teenager but will not go on to harm anybody else as an adult. So, and it's those people we really want to hear from. Because what happens in society generally is you hear the term sexual abuse, whether it's attached with child sexual abuse or sibling sexual abuse, and the big brush comes out that everybody who commits sexual abuse is a pedophile or a predator. And we know that's not true with sibling sexual abuse. So I have all the time in the world for somebody who caused harm and feels real shame, real remorse, wants to make things better. I have stories in my story portal on my website from precisely those people who have no idea what to do next, who don't know where to go, who don't know that they really could go into therapy, who are sitting at home going, I know that I did this horrid, horrible thing to my sibling, and I want to hurt myself, or all these sorts of, where do I go? So they don't know that it's okay, for example, to go get therapy to improve their mental health. And those are the people I have time for because they're not going to go on and hurt anybody else.
Thank you,
So I
Nancy.
think that real distinction is there for me as a survivor.
Chris, I'm going to come back to you after this break. Don't go anywhere.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
To today's show, I'm going to hand you over to Chris. You've been desperate with a hand up there waiting. Chris, it's over to you.
Hi, everyone. So I've got 3 points just to pick up on what Nancy and EJ were saying before the break. Language is really important when we come to talk about perpetration of crime here. When it's an adult on a child, then obviously there's a clear-cut crime and we can call them perpetrators, sexual offenders, whatever. But when we move into where it's child on child abuse, We usually use the terminology the harmer and the harmed, because as you were explaining before the break, Nancy, those that have caused some harm and are completely and utterly ashamed of what they've done, they no longer perpetrate anything as an adult, but they're living with that shame. It's to make sure that that crime potentially doesn't follow that person that may have harmed as a child or young person. It doesn't follow them for the rest of their lives. And again, it's just getting your head around what is it you're saying about whom and when and why. So using the right language at the right time is really important, that I've learned as I've gone on in this conversation. Now, prevention, we touched upon a few things. When does child curiosity cross the line, for example? Children just being children, natural curiosity. But there is a big difference between that, playing doctors and nurses, for example, you show me yours if I show you mine. There's a big difference between that and actually incidences of harm and the impact of that. And I'm just going to sort of say that what opportunities are existing in that family environment for those incidences of harm to take place. And I think once we drill down into maybe closing some of those opportunity quote mark gaps, we can better prevent and better protect. So I would love to hear your views on that in a moment. But I also would like to think, within my own family history, there was some SSA, but not on a scale where it harmed, as you've explained and what Hollyoaks is showing. Because there was a lot of domestic violence going on, there was a lot of dysfunction, a lot of chaos. There was also a lot of sexual abuse going on between adults and children. The children naturally did some of this harming, but it wasn't seen and taken as harm. It was almost taken as comfort, wrongly or rightly. I hope you can understand and where I'm coming from here. And there was shame as adults, but once the conversation was had, it was like, actually, you can really understand how children are having incidences of abuse on other children when you've got all of that other abuse going on, because it's just the norm. You see it, you hear it, you live within it. Is it right? No, but it does happen in some households. So there's a lot to unpick there, and I would love to have your thoughts on all of that.
Well, I think you bring up again something that we already see in the research, that when there is, not all the time, but quite often, when there's multiple factors occurring within a family, the incidence of SSA might go up. And it is well known and it's well seen that, particularly what you were saying about providing comfort in an inappropriate way, children will be drawn together to provide comfort in very stressful situations because of the environment. That's not the Hollyoaks storyline, as far as I know, but you know, it is known to be happening. And again, that's what differentiates SSA from CSA. So is that child who perpetrates that harm at that time then a criminal? Well, currently in our court system, they could be considered that way. And that is fundamentally, to me, as a survivor of SSA, completely wrong. That, you know, as you say, there's these dimensions that come in here that we need to look at. But at the moment, everybody who presents to either, sort of not everybody, but quite a lot of people who present to social services or the police or whatever, this big brush of sexual abuser comes out and just sweeps everybody up, which to me is one of the problems that we have and one of the reasons why society has so much stigma towards something like SSA. You know, and this misunderstanding needs to be clarified, which swings us back to the importance of the Hollyoaks storyline, that this will create these conversations. From a dramatic point of view, they probably need to go to the extremes of SSA, but there's a range of behaviors that fall into SSA the one that you're referring to would quote unquote fall into that, but it would probably deemed more problematic or inappropriate rather than sort of full-on abuse. And again, it's helping people to learn about this, but also helping the survivors and those who cause harm. So I have stories in my portal at siblings2.com, from people who've done just that, who in a need for themselves as a coping strategy for the extraordinary stresses they were under as like 10-year-olds, sought solace in their sibling. Now they're 30, 40 years old, and they consider themselves to be heinous criminals, when in actual fact, they were 10-year-olds seeking comfort. That was their primary motivator. It wasn't a sexually driven deviant behavior. And this is the brush. We need to get that clarity out there in the world that somebody who commits that kind of harm, still has terrible impacts potentially for the survivor. So that needs to be taken into consideration. But society needs to understand and empathize with perhaps those who cause harm more than they currently do. That's one of the things I hope comes out of the Hollyoaks and the various discussions. So it's just not Hollyoaks, but it's all those discussions that are going to happen in the media, in, on daytime television shows, in Instagram posts and things like that, where people such as myself and Sarsas or whomever is out there sharing the real information that we know to be true. So that's a great point. The thing that's interesting for me is that we, and I think I mentioned this before, is we just tend to use the word crime whenever we're talking about child abuse. And with regard to sibling sexual abuse, this is, in my opinion, and what a lot of research shows, particularly in like Australia and other jurisdictions, that in actual fact, sibling sexual abuse is a public health issue, not a criminal justice issue, for the most part. Should some people be involved in criminal justice? Absolutely. And sometimes that's the only way for the family to access services is to have police involved, which is unfortunate because if there was another way for people to access those services, particularly when they don't have the finances to go the private route, for example, that would be really helpful. But if we keep calling sibling sexual abuse 100% of the time a crime, then we're actually part of the problem. So we really need to differentiate between the quote unquote predator in training or those who commit heinous violent acts of sibling sexual abuse, and pull apart some of the dynamics that may be in play that contributed to somebody's really, really, really poor behavior and bad decisions.
Fancy, I'm really interested now. Have you always thought this way?
No, hell no. No,
What
I
changed? When
never
did it
thought.
change for you? What changed? When did it change?
As I've been speaking with professionals and academics around the world, for my awareness day and things like that, getting all this information and from jurisdictions who are already viewing SSA as a public health issue, I never wanted my brother to be involved in the court system. So in some respects, I suppose I have thought for the long time, even when I was a kid, it's not like I wanted him to be sent away to jail or anything like that. I wanted the behavior to stop and for it to be recognized that there was a problem. But I never wanted him to be involved in the criminal justice system. I think just now, with all the work that I've been doing and people that I've been learning from in different parts of the world, really focusing attention on public health. I'm a psychologist, so I understand brain development. I understand there are periods of time as we grow from like 5 to say 15 that, the brain is fundamentally messed up in many different ways. You just look at the behavior of teens generally. And the lack of awareness of the impacts of one's behavior, consequences, consciousness, these sorts of things are health issues. And going back to what you were saying, Chris, it can be a coping strategy to reach out and in that sort of way because they know no other way of getting that sense of being loved or appreciated than to demand it from perhaps a sibling. They have no other coping strategies, which is mental health. That isn't a criminal thing. So it's only in the last few years of as I've been doing this work that I more clearly see a path to prevention that is about public health, not criminal justice. There's no doubt there are people out there who behave in a way harm their siblings, are violent towards their siblings, all of these sorts of things that require criminal intervention or would fall under that category of crime for sure. But I also know, particularly as I look further into the research, which, as we said, is lacking, and we need some more. But what we know from what's there is that most of this behavior does not is not solely from somebody who's on a path of criminality for the rest of their lives. And that is a distinction that, what we've seen in other jurisdictions around the world is as soon as you start changing the story from crime to public health, it actually softens the subject. So parents are more likely to reach out for support if they feel that it's going to be treated as a health issue, and if their child had a quote unquote mental health concern, they would have no problem going to a doctor saying we have this concern about, say, depression. But when we look at sibling sexual abuse as just a criminal matter, parents hesitate, perpetrators hesitate, survivors hesitate. Rather than if we can change the story and make this a public health issue, I think we have more opportunity in terms of prevention for sure. And of course, obviously, an intervention in future if we look at it from a health perspective.
I'm going to stop you there, Nancy. We have to take another break now. But this is such is always a big conversation. We're never going to give it justice in the time that we have. That's why we keep getting you back on. Don't go anywhere, anyone. Don't go anywhere. We will be back after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to today's show. We are talking about sibling sexual abuse. We have been focusing on the Hollyoaks storyline, and Nancy has been sharing her thoughts and insights into that. I know Chris wants to say a few things now, so I'm going to hand over to Chris. I do have a couple of other things to speak to you about, Nancy, before we go off air today, but the time is rattling away, and I get in trouble if I go over. So let's focus this next 8 minutes as best we can. Thank you, Chris.
So, for me, the question, what makes a child cause harm to another child when we're talking about sibling sexual abuse? And often I hear that it's the adult online porn that is creating a lot of children who are harming to harm. And also that the sexual abuse that they may have experienced themselves, they see it as normal, so they may go on to act out incidences of harm against a sibling. So I would love your points or views on that. And one thing else, when a parent has a harmed child and someone that is harming, how they deal with that, it must be just the worst case scenario ever. And I would love to know how your parents maybe dealt with your situation.
My parents never knew. I never disclosed to my parents, and they both passed away. So my parents never knew. My brother, my other brother, he wasn't that thrilled that it occurred, the details that he had, but I know he found himself caught in the middle. I recently did an interview for my podcast with somebody who studies non-abusive siblings and how they're impacted by CSA and SSA. It's fascinating, the sort of things that the other siblings in the family may experience. I've had the real honor of speaking with parents even recently. Again, I've done a recent interview with parents who found out that this was occurring in their family, and just the bomb that explodes in the house and all the emotions that the parents must deal with, and they have to deal with it. I'm a parent, a step parent. I can't imagine this, and I'm a survivor too, and I still can't imagine how I would feel. Parents generally, if your kids do something quote unquote wrong, they steal a candy bar from a corner shop. You feel like a terrible parent, like you failed them somehow. So I can't even imagine what happens in terms of the sort of where have I gone wrong. So I think that is a perspective that we must take into consideration because SSA isn't a situation that is occurring between siblings. That's not it at all. It is a whole family thing. It impacts the whole family. And subsequently, that whole family impacts the community. There are fundamental costs to society of sibling sexual abuse that are not being taken into consideration and things like that. So the parental willing, the parents' willingness to deal with the situation is super important here. They need to deal with the situation and take all of the noise in their own head and put it off to the side, as difficult as that may be. Then there is an opportunity for the trained professionals to step in, a minimal number that there are at the moment, but there are people, particularly there's more and more now because the subject's becoming more talked about. When I was young, this phrase didn't even exist. The term sibling sexual abuse didn't even exist. So now we have some real opportunities. But the parents' willingness to discuss this. But speaking about the parents, and I just want to mention this really quickly. Wouldn't it be amazing? It would be amazing if all of our parents could talk about things like sex and consent and all of these things openly. Well, we can't. Most parents are really awkward and uncomfortable in that conversation. Being more comfortable in that conversation and recognizing that you have, and as a parent, an influence over your children, it's not entirely your responsibility, but you have an influence over your children's concepts of the world and what is and is not acceptable behavior for sure. But one other conversation that parents can have that I think is missing starts very, very young, from tiny, tiny children. Helping children to understand the importance of the mutual relationship with siblings. Siblings is one of the most dynamic relationships in your life. It's very impactful for the entirety of your life. It's the longest relationship in your life. So you're either going to have an enemy or an ally for most of your life. And I don't think we take opportunities to reinforce the value of that sibling relationship. And that is a conversation, and that is a micro moments, a teaching moments for parents where they could change that. Hey, we need to have mutual respect here. Yes, there's sibling rivalry, but we need to have this mutual respect so that sibling A recognizes that if I hurt sibling B in any way, I could be destroying the most important relationship in my life.
Thank you, Nancy. Look, we're coming up to the end of the show. I want to just push it now to the survivor of sibling sexual abuse. We've talked a lot about parents, the perpetrator. We also need to understand the survivor. And I think, whilst I really commend everybody speaking about this and it's being on a soap opera, I want to go to the other end, the survivor who will suffer from being violated, the long-term damage, the delayed onset of development maturity. They will find coping mechanisms that they will need. I'm not a survivor of sibling sexual abuse, but I can imagine it will be very similar to anyone who was violated as a child, and the absolute car crash that happens when you have been abused in this way. And therefore, and I'm sure you both agree that whilst I think it's commendable that Hollyoaks are doing this storyline to find out more about prevention and cause, that we also remember and never lose sight of or forget the victims of this horrific abuse, because that's where my beginning and end is, and that is what I will take forward for protection. Nancy, thank you for coming on today. It's a pleasure for you, for me to hear you speak. You can find Nancy www.nancymorris.com. You can find Chris at chris_wwhf on Twitter, and also her charity at sob_org. Check her out, she's doing great work. If you want to connect with me in any way, anytime, I'm at EJ Taylor UK. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Johan. Thank you to Chris Tate and everyone behind the scenes working hard for these shows to happen. They are an important part of society. And thank you, Hollyoaks, for taking a very important storyline forward, because this will now open lots of other possibilities for survivors of sibling sexual abuse. I'll see you next time. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Chris.